Welcome to Conversations in Equine Science. My name is Kate Acton and I'm joined by Nancy McLean, and this is the podcast where we take equine research and try and make it accessible to horse owners and enthusiasts alike. Remember that with each topic we discuss, it's important to get professional advice before implementing any of the strategies.
This week, Kate and I are discussing an article that was written in 2020, and the name of it is How a Flu Virus Shut Down the U.S. Economy in 1872 by Infecting Horses. Now, this was written by Professor Ernest Freeburg. He's a professor of history from the University of Tennessee, and it's all about that in 1872, our country was growing, you know, we're a new country at that point in time, and everybody was wanting to kind of expand westward. Horses played a big role in that. And in September of 1872, a virus hit, and it was an equine flu virus, and it just kind of decimated our horse population. So Kate, I thought this was a nice read. I will put a link on the homepage, but I had no idea this occurred in 1872. I mean, I was doing some research on old equine diseases and came across this. And there's so many diseases that they didn't have that germ theory in the late 1800s, so they just did the best they could. And I won't tell the whole thing because I want to give you an opportunity to talk too, but it was amazing how this turned horse welfare around. So anyway, tell me what you thought.
I loved this because for any of you listening, it is written so well. It's so, the actual website, The Conversation, their tagline is academic rigor with a journalistic flair. So it's so digestible. It's a lovely read and it gives you that history. But as Nancy was saying about germ theory, they didn't know viruses existed. I think they say it's going to be another 20 years at that point before the actual theory or notion of a virus is something that people are aware of. So even at this time, when the horses succumbed to the flu, people weren't entirely sure if it could spread to them from the horses. They had no knowledge of how exactly these things worked. And one part is such a small part in this that I actually ended up latching onto probably a little bit more, is they talked about how, like, people essentially were panicking, trying to make the horses better because these horses were such a huge part of their livelihoods and infrastructure. And we can touch a little bit more on that in a minute. But they mention how they tried to come up with remedies because veterinary care was still primitive. So they were cleaning the stalls, they were blanketing the horses and changing the blankets. And then it says others promoted more dubious remedies, such as gin and ginger, tinctures of arsenic, and even a bit of faith healing. But with the faith healing, I wondered, you know how we've done papers now where it shows massage makes such a difference to horses? I was like, I wonder if they did some hands-on faith healing and they did see some positive results from it. Not necessarily from the faith being instilled, but from the hands-on work with these horses who wouldn't have necessarily been shown that type of kindness. They were very much a working horse.
Yeah, it is so, I don't know. I was amazed that to do a comparable event with this, it would be like gas pumps shutting down and us losing our entire electrical grid. So that's the impact having these horses. And, you know, it did kill 2% of an estimated 8 million horses in North America. Now, it started in Canada, outside of Toronto, and within a few days, it was at the border of the United States, and then it just branched out from there. And if you do look at this article, they have a pretty neat map that is time specific, and it shows you how quickly the equine flu spread at that point in time. And I think the sad thing is that the horses sometimes were still made to work, even though they might have been coughing and feverish. And there's a sentence in this article that says one wag wrote in the Chicago Tribune that the nation's many abused and overworked horses were bound to die of shock from this sudden outpouring of kindness. So I looked up what the term wag really meant, and it means comedian. So it was someone kind of being facetious that, oh my God, these horses aren't going to die of the flu. They're going to die of shock because they're being treated so well. So
yeah. You know, because many, even though they essentially succumbed to the flu, it would have been because they were still being worked and their body was being put under the stress of work.
Yeah, and a lot of them died right there in their harness. And yeah. They also, some of the Americans were really concerned because they were going through an epidemic of cholera, dysentery, and yellow fever, and they were afraid this flu would be contagious and it would be yet another disease that they would have to deal with their families. So, and that never did happen, but that's what they were afraid of. And because of this, horses being down and sick, coal mines could not, there was no way to hold the haul the coal out of the mines. Crops never made it to market. You know, there was a big fear of coal famines going on, and you know, winter was coming on, and people were afraid they were going to be cold and not able to heat their dwellings and all that. So the economy just plunged into a steep recession. So
and
I think
some desperate companies even resorted to having men pull wagons to try and get the food to market and to get the coal.
It was, well, did you see the one photo has the men hauling a trolley car full of people? And it's just like, you know, it's not the same. The horses were used for so many things that I'm reading a book on the history of the horses being used to help industrialize the United States. And one of the first steam engines or type of trains, I should say. The first one was powered by a horse treadmill. So the car was on the railway, but the horses were on it walking on a treadmill to power it, and two draft horses could get it to go about 20 miles per hour.
No way.
So yeah, yeah.
That's incredible. I never knew that.
I had never heard of a horse treadmill other than what you do for research.
Yeah.
And at this, they were talking about horses being used to power the first type of train. And I thought, I have never heard of the horses doing that before. And so they were so important. And then they also were the only way a fireman could get to a fire.
Yes. I saw that in this paper and absolutely like blew me away when you think about that. It's all the intricacies. Like you don't think about the fact the horses were pulling the ambulances and the fire brigades that we now take for granted can just drive places.
Yeah. And they, you know, a lot of times at first when, now this isn't in the article, but this is in the book I'm reading about the history of the horse. The firehouse was one place they kept the fire horses down the street in a stable. Soon they knew that wasn't working because they'd have to run and harness them and then go to the fire. So what they did was move the stables into the firehouses, and then they could run and harness the horses and get to the fire. So anyway, because of this flu, on November 9th, 1872, there was a catastrophic blaze, which gutted much of downtown Boston. So, you know, you don't realize what an impact these horses being sick made on our society. And the good part of it is that it made us so much more aware of welfare concerns for the horses.
Yeah. And in the paper, they go on to talk about Henry Burr, who was essentially the founder of the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in 1866. So this happened in 1872. So he was already ahead of his time with trying to promote animal welfare. And he played such an important role in trying to protect these horses, even to the point where he stood in the street policing what horses were being used. And if he deemed a horse to be sick, he sent the people back to the stables with the horse, and even sent some people to court as well for having taken the horse out in the first place.
Yeah. And the neat one of my favorite sentences is, motivated less by the love of animals than by a hatred of human cruelty. So he was very wealthy, had a lot of connections, and he was a pretty good writer and had literary talent. So he ended up using his talent and his wealth to lobby the New York's legislature, and they passed the nation's first modern anti-cruelty statute. Now, that made it a law, and that granted him police powers that he could send people to the courts for being abusive to their horses. And he actually stood in the kind of like, I think what would be the town square, and would inspect the horses as they went by. And if they looked sick, he would stop the wagon or the carriage or whatever, and the people would get fined and the horses would be sent back to their stables to rest. So I had never heard the name Henry Burr before.
Yeah, and it says that, I hadn't either, but it says that because of this work he did, thousands of other women and men across the country took his lead, got similar laws passed, and then essentially founded branches of the SPCA. So that's how it spread across America.
Yeah, and then I thought it was comical that traffic piled up. And so grumbling, and some of them threatened to sue him and they ridiculed him, but there were many, many more people that applauded his work. And, you know, he's got a unbelievable monument in the Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, New York. It's got this like copper horse with him hugging it and kind of standing beside it with all these other animals by it. And it's kind of like his own little mausoleum. So, you know, the flu started this, or kind of didn't start it. It helped him have a platform to be able to make changes.
Yeah. And they said in the kind of final moments of the journal that the movement reminded Americans that horses were not unfeeling machines, but partners in building and running the modern city. And I think that book you're reading, Nancy, would be so fascinating because they did play such a huge role. Like, the expansion wouldn't have been possible without them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, they were so important. And I think the further and further we get from that, we forget it. We forget how people depended on them to get them out west and to help us with, you know, soon the steam engine came along. But first, it was the horse that showed, you know, they powered everything. I don't think there, you know, was too much they didn't power. So it was there was one instance where there was a ship outside of England that ran into problems and lost its anchor. And it was during a bad storm, and they hitched up 18 draft horses to pull a lifeboat, which was like 32 feet long, 10 tons in weight. And the horses pulled it across the land to get it to the other more, I guess, peaceful area of the sea where they could get it to the ship so these men could be rescued.
Wow.
And I know, and I had never heard that before. Maybe Kate will have to take some of the book and make them into episodes, because horses have really been amazing. And I don't think, unless you're reminded of it or you're kind of looking into it, I think we forget that.
Yeah, I don't think they get like the full recognition, I suppose, for their work in the past in developing our economy and the role that they've played in that. So it's nice to be kind of doing a couple episodes to honor them, I guess, and the role that they've played. But I also thought, in kind of comparing this to today's world, I think we can sometimes see this where activists a lot of the time get a bad rap, or they can be looked at as extremists. But I think we need to, and Nancy and I have talked about this, be open to conversations a lot more about horse rights and just see where those conversations lead. It doesn't mean that, you know, one side or the other is correct or incorrect, but just kind of open up the conversation more and see, can we make changes that will ultimately improve welfare? Because at the time that Henry Burr started this, people thought he was completely just crazy to be standing up for horses in this way, and, you know, that he didn't understand. And I think a lot of the time that can kind of be perpetuated still towards animal rights people. So I suppose just some food for thought maybe going forward to try and open up that dialogue.
Yeah, and I always will remember the paper we did on the Grand National, and Inga Wolfram was one of the authors on that paper, and how, you know, a lot of us in the horse industry, we may think we know what we're doing and we may think it's perfectly fine. But when people outside of the industry criticize, maybe we need to not be so defensive and actually hear what they're saying and address it. And whether, you know, it's a welfare concern or a practice that's taking place. I mean, I think there's always room to explain and to talk without getting so defensive and argumentative.
Yeah, definitely.
And this kind of is what happened here. So anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed it today. I certainly enjoyed reading it and would highly recommend it. It's not that long of a read, and it's very interesting.
And this website, as I was saying to Nancy at the beginning, has entirely drawn me in. I have like four other tabs open of topics I never would have thought to look up or read into. So this is going to take up a lot of my time, I think, over the coming days.
Okay. Well, and thanks, Kate, for joining in. I thought it made a good conversation.
Thanks, Nancy, for suggesting it. It was brilliant. And we will see you all next week.
Okay. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Take care.